Numbed by the absurdity of our democracy in action, we'll now spend the rest of the show visiting two stories that wrangle over the nature of nihilism, one from Radiolab's Jad Abumrad and the other by me. Our argument played out last summer. Then the news was especially grim. Ebola was raging in West Africa, and beheadings were still a hideous novelty. And then in the midst of all of that, something weird happened to Jad's brother-in-law.
I am Eugene Thacker. I'm an author and professor at the New School in New York City.
Jad asked me to join him and Eugene to talk about what happened.
Eugene is a hardcore scholar of philosophy, and he writes these books that sometimes can be a little dense. I mean, he'll use words like exegesis and ratiocination. And so the family joke is that he writes books for no one.
I think the joke started out, I write books that nobody reads. And then after a slow, long period of acceptance, I started to think, well, maybe I should write books for no one to read and just sort of embrace that.
So the story begins a couple years ago.
In 2011.
Eugene writes this book.
Called In the Dust of This Planet. It's about the end of the world.
But not in the Hollywood sense. It's darker than that.
Your hypothesis is the greatest horror is that nothing exists and nothing matters.
Right. What in philosophy is often referred to as nihilism or pessimism, that there might not be a purpose to things or to your life or to our existence or to the cosmos, and this all might be purely arbitrary and an accident.
That there's no inherent meaning to anything.
That it just doesn't matter.
This is what Nietzsche called
the most difficult thought.
And in the book, Eugene traces this idea through all of these different horror movies, from slasher films to sort of more supernatural horror. And also music. I mean, at one point he goes into this deconstruction of how different types of black metal deal with this thought.
I don't know. It's a way of thinking I've always found really intriguing and ironically kind of inspiring.
Are you a pessimist?
On my better days.
Are you a nihilist?
Not as much as I should be.
Okay, so Eugene writes this book in 2011. It is dark. It is dense. He writes it, as he says, for no one, and as expected, beyond a few philosophy types, no one really pays attention. So he keeps his head down, teaching, writing. But then, some things happen. 2014.
All kinds of ghettos in the world.
It's all one ghetto, man. Giant gutter in outer space.
The show True Detective comes along. Comes a big hit. And at the center of the show is this character, Russ Cole, this Louisiana detective, who's one dark dude.
I think human consciousness is a tragic misstep in evolution.
He goes on these rants about how there's no order in the world, how humans are just this accident, we have to deal with that.
Look, I'd consider myself a realist, all right, but in philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist.
And I just remember watching it and being like, wow.
That's Eugene's wife, Prema Murthy, my sister-in-law.
I was like, this replicates so many conversations that we've had in the car.
She's like, were they listening in on us?
Yeah, it was eerie.
So Prema goes online, clicks around.
And all of a sudden, I see this article about the True Detective director.
It was an article where actually the writer of the show, Nick Pizzolatto, was asked, how did you create that character of the nihilist police detective? And he lists a bunch of things he was reading at the time.
And included in that list was Eugene.
To which I was like, cool. At least one person is reading the book.
But I really just try to key my head to the ground and just keep writing, just doing what I'm doing.
But then, things got weirder.
Okay, so now let's pull up the Lucky magazine. Let's see if we can find it.
Short time later, Prema is flipping through this fashion magazine.
Lucky magazine, and there was a spread with this actress.
Lily Collins, 25-year-old actress.
Who I'd never heard of.
Pretty big right now. She's standing on a street corner.
Dressed up in all of this sort of goth makeup and clothing.
And in the photo, she is wearing Eugene's book on her chest.
She had on, in one of the shots, a sweatshirt that had the cover of the book.
In the Dust of This Planet. Big letters right on her chest.
And I was just like, no way.
I mean, it was definitely, what the
f- This is crazy. Yeah. Like, what? She's just casually wearing my husband's book cover.
I don't know. Again, I didn't react to, but it was just strange.
Turns out a Norwegian artist had made a painting of the book. That image had gotten picked up by a fashion label and turned into some very expensive clothes. Okay, so that happened. But then it gets weirder still. So one day, my wife, Carla Murthy, is online. This is the day that Jay-Z and Beyonce announced they're going to do this big international tour. Carla's watching the video that they released to promote that tour, sort of a fake movie trailer.
So it says On the Run, it's all flashy, guns, fire, hookers.
Beyonce's in a wedding dress.
She's got a veil on.
But she's shooting semi-automatic weapons in her wedding dress, cut to car chases, cut to money flying everywhere. But at exactly 37 seconds in.
Of course, oh, then. Go back. It's like you're making me think too fast.
You see Jay-Z turn, stick a giant gun out to his right, and he is wearing Eugene's book. Right there on his back, in the dust of this planet. Now, this is the point at which I was like, okay, what do we make of this? I mean, could it be that Eugene is no longer writing books for no one, that somehow he has become a conduit for this idea that we all, in that subterranean way that pop music operates, that we all are channeling right now? That was my thought.
Yeah, no, I think that's the question, is whether this is something particular to the moment we're living in.
And Eugene, his knee-jerk reaction is,
I think it could have been this cover or a million other covers.
No. This is just meaningless appropriation.
I don't think there's anything more than that to me. Then it's just, it looks like a cool phrase to go on a t-shirt to put on a goth girl in some photo shoot.
And why is it cool?
Right. Because my hunch is you might be right, but mm-hmm. you also might be wrong because of the answer that you're about to give to Brooke's question.
It's cool because some publicist
No.
I mean, this was sort of the conversation I wanted to have, and it's why I called Brooke. Like, what is behind all of this nihilistic entertainment that's everywhere? Now, Brooke, for her part, agreed that Eugene probably is tapping into something.
Yes, but is this unique to this moment? And to that, I would say no.
Really? You don't think this says anything about now?
I think there are cycles in which the sense of meaninglessness comes out in sharper relief than other times. Mm. But you can identify them over and over again.
Yeah. Nihilism goes all the way back.
Brooke actually turned us on to this guy.
Simon Critchley. I am the Hans Jonas Professor at the New School for Social Research.
Simon wrote an article that basically made the argument that nihilism is the basic credo of cool.
Because it's sexy, it's interesting,
and it's been that way forever.
Oh, I've got the best thing for you. You'll love this. It's a Russian word, right?
He said the word really got its pop in 1862. This is 150 years ago.
There's a novel by Turgenev called Fathers and Sons.
And in the novel, the son, who's the nihilist, turns to his conservative dad. And he says,
we base our conduct on what we recognize as useful. In these days, the most useful thing we can do is to repudiate. And so we repudiate everything. The father says, everything? Everything. With indescribable composure. So that's the nihilist moment. Everything goes.
And Simon says, roughly from that point on, you see young people glom on to this idea again and again as a way to, you know, say no to the older generation or to just what's happening in the world.
Pop culture, at least since I was a kid, has always been deeply nihilistic, you know.
All right, so it's nothing new. But when I ran Simon through the Eugene jacket situation, and then I asked him, like, is there something different about today's nihilism versus nihilisms of the past? Like, is there something more potent about it? Without hesitation, he said,
I'd say yes, mm-hmm.
Huh.
Based on what?
That's producer Andy Mills, who was with me during the interview.
Well,
Simon says it was more of a gut feeling based on this class that he taught last year with Eugene, oddly enough. I didn't actually know that they knew each other, but they had taught this class together.
So the seminar that we did in the fall last year was one of those rare seminars. We're teaching mysticism. Nobody teaches mysticism.
He says they started the seminar not really expecting much, by talking about how in the 4th century A.D.
there was a city, Alexandria.
This is near Egypt.
Right. Alexandria was a lot like Manhattan. It was an offshore island, and it's the seat of all culture and all learning in the ancient world. At a certain point in the 4th century, people start to leave. People wander off, and they seem to want something else. The city doesn't do it anymore.
Why?
It's corrupt. It's broken. It's sinful.
He said crime was rampant, pollution, and so people just started to wander off into the desert and live in these caves.
And these intense forms of ascetic practice begin.
Like you had these women who were so enraptured with Christ that they began
hurting themselves, throwing themselves into icy rivers, jumping into ovens. The body is something which is you're trying to strip away in order that you can free the capacity for love. But the premise of that, again, is that the world is a kind of field of ruins.
But he says what really struck him is that as he was talking about all this, he would glance out at the students and he would notice this look in their eyes.
I just felt that in the room there was this deep need was being fulfilled by these strange mystics.
What exactly? I mean, do you think they were starting to form the thought of wandering into the desert, so to speak?
Yeah, I think there's a sense in which you know, what do you do? Secede, walk away. You know, that's where a lot of people are at.
As for what's behind it all, he says just turn on the news.
A video showing the beheading of a second American journalist has now been verified.
Disease experts say this is turning into one of the longest, deadliest outbreaks ever.
The girls were gang raped and strangled.
Once again, it is mostly children we are seeing brought into this hospital.
I mean, the world I grew up in made sense. It was completely crazy, mutually assured destruction, but it made sense. And you could understand it in very simple terms. There was the United States, there was the Soviet Union. We were going to be eviscerated. That was clear. But, you knew what the balance of power was.
You're nostalgic for mutually assured destruction? Is that what's happening now?
It seems a much simpler world.
You at least knew who to blame for it, right?
Right.
That's Andy again.
And now?
Yeah.
Who am I supposed to say f*** you to? I'm saying f*** you to...
Everybody.
Carbon emissions!
Speaking of which...
Today, the world's leading climate scientists warn it will get worse.
No doubt, one of the reasons for the current gloom is that we are in the middle of an uncomfortable shift in how we talk about climate change.
Heat waves will be more frequent and last longer.
This was made official when the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released a report where, for the first time, they stopped using the language of prevention and shifted to the language of adaptation. In other words, hundreds of scientists and policymakers, this is the world's top organization for assessing climate change, we're now saying, we can't stop it. It's inevitable.
So now we need to talk about dealing with the mess that is now on our doorstep.
That's David Victor,
professor of international relations at University of California at San Diego.
And he is one of the authors of the report.
When the IPCC first began back in the late 1980s, you could imagine that people would take the climate change problem seriously. They would start to control emissions. And then over a period of decades, climate would stop changing. And instead, what's happened is people have talked a lot about climate change, but they haven't actually done much to control emissions. You know, the report says, if you put into place all these technologies and international agreements, we could still stop warming at 2 degrees. My own assessment is that the kinds of actions you'd need to do that are so heroic that we're not going to see them on this planet.
All of which reminded me of that True Detective moment.
Look, I'd consider myself a realist, all right? But in philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist.
Okay, what's that mean?
Well, pessimists like nihilists agree there's no meaning. They're just a little more mopey about it, less likely to do something.
Means I'm bad at parties.
I mean, is that where we're all headed? You know, in a recent Wall Street Journal poll, 76% of people 18 and over weren't confident that the future is going to be brighter than the past. Which brings me back to Brooke's question.
Why is it cool?
Call it nihilism, pessimism, whatever. Shouldn't it be depressing? Why would you want to put a phrase like in the dust of this planet? A phrase that deliberately negates the person wearing it. Why would you want to put it on your chest or on your back?
Yeah, we encourage it.
And since it was Jay-Z's jacket, which was in a way the catalyst for this whole podcast, we ended up in the flow of things.
Like, they want to talk to me? Why?
That's a good question.
Talking to this lady, who it turns out was the person who made the decision to put it on Jay-Z's back.
I should say my name, I guess. My name is June Ambrose. I've been a costume designer for 22 years, 23 this year, and I've worked with everyone from Luther Vandross to Puffy to Sean to Mariah Carey, Busta Rhymes. Mary J. Blige, Alicia Keys, Dave Matthews Band, Backstreet Boys, Kelly Ripa, Kim Cattrall,
do this, but,
R. Kelly,
go ahead on, bro. I'm off with a little...
Jamie Foxx, Missy Elliott,
and of course, Jay-Z and Beyonce. It occurred to Andy and I during the interview that June has probably influenced the fashion sense of a significant portion of the human beings on this planet. And she was very clear that a costume is more than just a costume.
It's like a conversation without words.
That really what she's doing when she styles someone is whispering to all the people that are going to watch the videos, come in contact with the billboards, go to the concerts.
Like, I don't have to talk to you, but I can create this conversation with a pair of pants and how they fall and how they fit and the texture and the color and the feel.
She says with Jay-Z for that video, she knew she needed something epic.
But like effortless. I knew I wanted a biker jacket because it was a motorcycle scene, but I knew that I just couldn't give him a black leather. I needed to say something. So we were on the hunt.
Her and her assistant went to dozens of places.
Ateliers, studios, and showrooms.
Looking at all these leather jackets.
It's like finding a needle in a haystack.
Nothing was right.
But then...
they saunter into this one place.
Black denim.
This place that does sort of high-end grunge. They're flipping through the racks when... she sees it. The jacket. Those words.
And that was it. I knew it. I said, this is what I need. It just felt... I mean, it was just perfect.
Question was why. At this point, I hadn't really told her the whole backstory. So I pulled out a screen capture from the video. This is one where you see Jay-Z sort of standing in the desert, shot from behind, in the dust of this planet on his back. And he's kind of pointing this really long, dirty, hairy gun off to his right, sort of up, like he's about to shoot the sun.
Yeah, you think he's about to shoot the sun.
Okay, so let's just look at this for a second.
Yeah.
So, like, why did you choose that jacket?
You know, it's something very menacing about it. It's almost like the aftermath. The end of an era, the beginning of something new.
She says in the back of her head she was thinking about how the music industry might be dying.
It's definitely in a place where it's like, what now? You can hear it in the music.
And, you know, if this is the biggest tour in history, really, what now?
You know, and these are the whispers that you hear.
But she says one of the loudest whispers was super simple. Just, here's a guy. Massive pop star.
Like a sovereign.
He's in the desert. It's about to go down. The end of the world is literally on his back.
But it was almost as if he didn't even know that was on his back. You know what I mean? It's like, that was the afterthought.
Like, oh yeah, the world's ending? Psst, I don't care.
Going out and stuff.
In other words?
He wasn't afraid.
He wasn't afraid.
Wasn't afraid.
You know what? That's what this... we talk about whispers. That's what I get from it. Now that you said that. It's not so much I don't give a shit, I'm not afraid.
Yeah. I mean, we all have to leave the planet. You know, everybody has their day. What you work on is not being afraid when you have to leave.
I think that that is nothing more than a posture. I mean, it's all fine when you're 18 to wear that t-shirt, but when you're like in your 50s dealing with cancer, like, okay, you know, maybe then is when you really have to confront those things. So it's simply a posture, and that's why it's in pop culture.
A quite cynical response would be to say, you know, why we love nihilism in pop culture is that it saves us having to be burdened with it.
Simon Critchley again.
It saves us from feeling it, right? We can enjoy it in our rooms. We can get off on it, and then we let it go. And we go back to work.
But Simon says, you don't have to be cynical about this if you don't want to be. I mean... Nietzsche, Mr. Dark Pessimist himself, had this idea about nihilism that it was just the beginning. That if you really dealt with it, took it in, accelerated it to its logical end, you could get to the other side, which he called...
a reevaluation of values. Some new way of thinking about who we are as moral creatures. And that's kind of where I am. And love. Love is that capacity which can see through that.
And that, he suspects, is why his students were so interested in those mystics, because they had found a way through.
These people, these mystics, have got the uncompromising commitment to something like love.
The fact that they were ready to go all the way, to negate even their own bodies for that love.
Right, so in a world where where love has been reduced to Tinder exchanges. If that's the hell that you're living in as a 25-year-old, then, yeah, you're going to read these mystics and think, I want what she's having, you know. I'll take what she's having.
Burn my flesh.
That's right, burn my flesh.
And you could argue, I mean, why not, that Jay-Z and Beyonce, they've got a little bit of that going on. I mean, part of what's made this tour so big, biggest tour ever, actually, is that it's like this grand love story.
I'm with the love of my life, so it's right. All, it's like, it works.
Well, but you'd say, but
I have a fantasy. Good. I have a fantasy that Beyonce and Jay-Z will do this tour, and they will go off into the desert and they'll live in a little hut, like this monastic existence. A new sort of Age of Aquarius will begin, starting with the two of them.
That's beautiful.
Any chance of that?
Pina colada on the beach.
Maybe a perfect response to Jared's question.
Yeah.